In June 2025, Nippon Steel acquired U.S. Steel, with the U.S. government retaining a golden share. Nippon Steel first announced the $14.9 billion acquisition back in December 2023, and the Japanese steel giant has pursued the deal despite competing American bids, union disapproval, and seemingly insurmountable political opposition. U.S. Steel was once the world's biggest steel company and remains America's third-largest steel maker. They now face considerable challenges. Nippon Steel was also once the world's largest steel company, and they now face substantial challenges. The two are now together. In today's video, Nippon Steel's historic acquisition of U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel has this long, illustrious history filled with America's most famous titans of industry, and I'm going to skip all that and catch us up on what they've been up to recently. Throughout the 1980s and 1990s, U.S. Steel undergoes massive site closures and job cuts to become a competitive company once again. By 2000, the company has reduced its once sprawling production U.S. footprint to just three big sites, Gary Works, Mon Valley, and Fairfield. There are a few minor sites for finishing or ore work, but those three are the big American ones. Despite its slimmed-down profile and greatly improved productivity, the company struggles through the 2000s and 2010s amidst a global steel glut and weak economic demand. Much trouble can be attributed to the strength of the mini-mills. Mini-mills use electric arc furnaces and continuous casting to melt down scrap steel for new steel bars, sheets, or strips. U.S. Steel, on the other hand, has been an integrated steel producer throughout its long history. This means owning all the major facilities that turn iron ore and coking coal into crude steel, notably the coking ovens to produce coke and blast furnaces to make pig iron. Mini mills are more flexible, use 30% less energy, put out 90% less emissions since they rely on electricity, and can be built cheaper and closer to where their end users are. They are the canonical example of technology disruption, taking down the big integrated steel players in the 1970s and 1980s. Today, over 70% of the steel in the U.S. steel market is made using electric arc furnaces. America's largest and most valuable steelmaker, Nucor, for instance, relies on mini mills, and they make twice as much revenue as U.S. Steel. Integrated steelmaking also has carbon concerns. Blast furnaces use a lot of energy and emit a lot of carbon. The EU has set aggressive carbon targets for the steel sold and used within its borders. So, if U.S. Steel wants access to that market, and they do because their one big overseas asset is a large integrated steel plant in Slovakia that contributes nearly 20% of revenue, then they must decarbonize at great cost. For a long time, U.S. Steel stuck to its integrated approach. Then, in October 2019, U.S. Steel announced that they paid $700 million for a minority stake in Big River Steel, which was building a big advanced mini mill in Arkansas. U.S. Steel thus changed its strategy to involve both integrated and mini mill steel operations, a strategy called best of both. In a later interview, U.S. Steel CEO David Burritt said that he felt that Big River can teach his company a bunch of new things about how to operate, and U.S. Steel can, in turn, introduce new customers and collaborate on advanced steels. People were initially skeptical. Several recognized the value of mini mills, but were unsure if the company can afford it. The stock slumped another 15% afterwards. A few years later, it seems like the acquisition is working. The mini mill segment, aided a bit by new tariffs in 2018, has grown by providing electrical steels for the booming EV motor, automotive and electrical equipment industries in the American South and Mexico. This stuff is pretty cool. U.S. Steel calls it Indux, but it is an ultra-thin, very light, non-grain-oriented steel that does not heat up as much when exposed to changing magnetic fields, useful anywhere electricity is being turned into motion or vice versa. So, not just EV motors, but also generators and transformers. Considering that the single biggest bottleneck in AI data center expansion is power, that's a pretty good area to be in. The Big River facility has now been expanded with a second unit, and going into 2025, nearly 40% of the company's steel is produced using electric arc furnaces. Sounds great, and the stock loves it, but this burgeoning mini-mill growth has created new tension with U.S. Steel's union, the United Steelworkers. Electric arc furnace steelmaking involves less steps, smaller facilities, and smaller non-unionized work teams. The USW sees U.S. Steel's transition to electric arc furnaces has a plan to shift money away from areas and business models that favored organized labor. In other words, starving the unionized part of the company. The most public sign of such was U.S. Steel's April 2021 cancellation of a planned $1.5 billion investment to modernize the Mon Valley Works in an area outside of Pittsburgh. This announcement came after U.S. Steel exercised its option to acquire the rest of Big River Steel. Had the Mon Valley investment gone through, they might have been where those electric steels are made. Now it's being done in Arkansas with a non-unionized crew. In a press release, USW International President Tom Conway said, "It was just 2 short years ago when U.S. Steel touted the project and the dedicated workforce there as essential to the future of the Mon Valley Works and Pennsylvania steelmaking. The company then moved its attention to Arkansas when a shiny new object caught its attention in the form of Big River Steel." U.S. Steel's developing turnaround has brought buyers out of the steelwork. Per SEC filings, in the second half of 2023, two companies, a steel company and a private equity consortium, approached U.S. Steel unsolicited about a joint venture or asset sale. U.S. Steel passed. In July 2023, the first company, reports suggest either ArcelorMittal or Nucor, offered to buy U.S. Steel outright for $31.50 a share. The board rejected it because the price was too low and antitrust risk too high. Then in August 2023, Cleveland-Cliffs crashes through the wall like the Kool-Aid Man with an unsolicited buyout offer worth $35 per share, or $7.3 billion in total. Cleveland-Cliffs had once been Cliffs Resources, a raw materials company with iron ore and coal assets in the U.S. and abroad. Then, in 2014, they appointed an outspoken Brazilian-American named Lourenço Gonçalves as their chairman. Gonçalves quickly focused the company on U.S. iron ore and then steelmaking itself. Cleveland-Cliffs rapidly bought AK Steel, ArcelorMittal USA, and Stelco Holdings. Adding U.S. Steel would complete the transformation into a national steel champion. However, only half of their offer was in cash, and the antitrust concerns were significant. The combined company would control 100% of the U.S. iron ore market, which means divestments are for certain. And it would supply up to 90% of the steel to the automotive industry. They will certainly protest. The U.S. Steel Board, wanting to review it in more detail, asks to sign a confidentiality agreement, but Cleveland-Cliffs refuses, probably because they anticipate going public with it, and they do. So in the end, U.S. Steel turns down Cleveland-Cliffs II, and in August 2023, publicly announces a search for alternatives. Cleveland-Cliffs announces their offer too. Both stocks soar. At one time, the Japanese steel industry was the greatest in the world, with Nippon Steel its largest and mightiest company. I did a video about Nippon Steel's origins dating all the way back to the 1900s, so feel free to watch that. Nippon Steel's most significant ancestor was a government-backed steel facility called Yawada Steel. In the 1930s, the government merged Yawada with other privately owned companies to form Japan Iron and Steel, an integrated steel monopoly controlling both the iron and steel industries. This company was then split into two after World War II because of its participation in the Japanese war machine. But during a large steel glut in the 1960s, the two pieces merged together again in 1970 to form Nippon Steel. Oof, complicated, isn't it? Anyway, throughout the 1950s and 1960s, the Japanese aggressively built greenfield steel plants in coastal areas. These plants were not only massive, but also employed the latest technologies, like the basic oxygen furnace. Their steel was often sold to Japanese automakers or exported abroad. In the mid-1970s, Japan by itself accounted for almost a third of global steel exports. This jubilant steel market peaked in 1973 with the energy crises. After that, the Japanese steel industry began declining. As the world economy changed, new competition emerged, more on that later, the Plaza Accord revalued the Japanese yen, and the domestic Japanese market plunged into a decades-long downturn. Nippon Steel aggressively managed the change with extensive job cuts. They went from 75,000 employees to just 15,000. Cost reductions, shifts to higher-value steel products, and business diversifications. One failed diversification was a move into semiconductors in the 1980s. After just 5 years, they realized that they were totally out of their depth and sold it off to Taiwan's UMC, losing $1 billion in total. But those losses were nothing compared to another big Nippon Steel L, their efforts nurturing foreign competitors. After the energy crises, the Japanese steel industry began exporting their steel technology and know-how to developing economies like Brazil and Taiwan. Many customers saw steel as a cornerstone of industrial policy and wanted their own steelworks. Japan taught them what they knew. The most egregious efforts were POSCO in South Korea and Baosan Steel in the People's Republic of China. I shall skip the circumstances of the deals. They are essentially efforts to better relations between Japan and those countries. But Nippon Steel gave the technology transfer a full and earnest effort, and it worked, perhaps too well. POSCO became one of the world's biggest and most advanced steelmakers. In 2000, they were the world's number two steelmaker, and today they are still number eight. And as for China, before Nippon came along, Chinese steel production was hopelessly behind. It took 70 man-hours to produce a single ton of steel. With Nippon's complete and total system transfer, Baosan Steel cuts that down to just four, blossoming into mainland China's most advanced steelmaker. They eventually absorb others to become Baowu Steel Group, the world's largest steel company today. In 2024, Baowu put out 130 million tons of steel, more than the second and third largest steelmakers combined. Nippon Steel maintained a joint venture with Baosan for 20 years until 2024, when they sold their 50% share. People were grateful. POSCO's co-founder was very complimentary of Nippon Steel, and Deng Xiaoping called Nippon Steel chairman Inayama Yoshihiro an old friend of China's. But that is small compensation. China's economic rise triggered a wave of consolidations up and down the steel supply chain. On the steel vendor side, the iron ore makers combined into global giants like Rio Tinto and BHP, controlling over 70% of the world ore market. And then on the steel customer side, the big automakers, a critical steel user, were also consolidating. And now the top 10 automakers control 80% of global car production. The steel companies have to size up to match with these new giants, and an aggressive buyer led the way. Throughout the early 2000s, Mittal Steel, founded and run by the Indian steel magnate Lakshmi Mittal, has grown massive by buying smaller steelmakers around the world. In 2006, Mittal Steel launches a hostile bid for ArcelorSteel, Europe's largest steelmaker. After a vicious battle worthy of another video, Mittal succeeds, paying $34 billion to create the largest steelmaker the world had ever seen up until then, ArcelorMittal. The ArcelorMittal deal deeply shook the Japanese steel players because it showed them that even they were not safe. The Japanese steel industry needed to get bigger to keep up with the rest. These thoughts led Nippon Steel to merge with Japan's number three steelmaker Sumitomo in 2012. The new Nippon Steel quickly became the second largest steelmaker in the world, but has again lost share as the Chinese rise. Over 10 years later, the steel industry is poised for another wave of consolidation. The Chinese steel industry is in the midst of an immense glut. In August 2024, Baowu Steel Group's chairman Hu Wangming said that China's steel industry was in a, quote, severe crisis and a, quote, harsh winter. In other words, there are still too many steelmakers in China. In 2022, the top 10 Chinese steelmakers made about 43% of the country's steel. The government wants to raise that ratio to 60 to 70%. You know where this goes. The harsh winter will be harsh, but it will eventually forge a cluster of ultra-competitive Chinese steelmakers with global ambitions. Nippon Steel needs to keep up with that, and Japan's domestic market is not enough. Vice Chairman Takahiro Mori has said, quote, growth can only be expected overseas, end quote. Chairman and CEO Eiji Hashimoto has talked about creating an iron triangle between Japan, India, and the United States. And the U.S. picking up a more protectionist bent, i.e. tariffs, means establishing and growing a sufficient U.S. beachhead inside the tariff wall. In late August 2023, Nippon Steel signs a confidentiality agreement with U.S. Steel, officially entering the horse race. In September, they offer to purchase only U.S. Steel's mini mills and mining assets for $9 billion, but that was rebuffed. With Cleveland-Cliffs raising their offer, U.S. Steel asks Nippon to buy the whole company, so Nippon comes back with a very good offer. After evaluating all the offers, U.S. Steel invites the five most serious bidders to the second round. Concerned about the substantial antitrust risks, they ask these parties for a hell-or-high-water clause. I love this phrase, hell-or-high-water. It essentially makes the buyer do whatever it takes to close the deal. Antitrust, politics, whatever. Cleveland-Cliffs rejects that clause, telling U.S. Steel that they are willing to sell up to $2 billion of assets to fulfill the U.S. government's antitrust concerns, but no more. They also raise their termination fee to $1.5 billion. Nippon Steel initially rejected the clause too, but after U.S. Steel told them that their offer wasn't competitive, Nippon put it into the contract in December 2023, assuming that the effort doesn't materially affect their legacy U.S. assets. Nippon Steel already has two factories in the U.S. So now we cookin'. This, plus a very nice all-cash offer of $55 per share, gave U.S. Steel the confidence to move forward. A week later, the board voted its approval and the deal announced. Knowing what happened next, the hell or high water clause makes a whole lot of sense. Right from the get-go, the optics of an iconic 122-year-old steel company being bought by, of all companies, Japan's Nippon Steel, were not great. People have long memories, and in their minds, Japan and their cheap steel imports killed the good old days. And even setting that history aside, people expressed concerns about a foreign country, quote-unquote, owning U.S. Steel. Isn't steel really important? Isn't this a national security issue? For their part, the USW long ago announced that it exclusively favored Cleveland-Cliffs as the buyer. The two have a long working relationship. The USW's international president told Reuters in 2023, Cliffs is committed to the blast furnace segment of the steel market, and U.S. Steel is not. Of course, government got involved. The U.S. president at the time, Joe Biden, had long supported unions, and Pennsylvania, the state where U.S. Steel is headquartered, would be a critical swing state in the then-upcoming presidential election. In March 2024, the president says that he has concerns about the deal. Various senators and then-candidate Trump also say the same. For the workers, Nippon Steel adds sweeteners, one of which being a pledge to invest over $1 billion into Mon Valley and $300 million into Gary Works. And I think that means a lot to the actual rank-and-file workers at Mon Valley, who are hopeful. But the USW upper ranks and U.S. government remain unconvinced. In January 2025, shortly before leaving office, the outgoing president puts an executive order blocking the deal on national security grounds. In normal times, a death knell. So the U.S. government blocked the deal. Now what? Cleveland-Cliffs pushes for their merger proposal, saying that a Nippon Steel-U.S. Steel deal has no pathway to close, which kind of feels like a guy telling a girl to date him because she's got no one better around. CEO Gonsalves made a few waves when he painted Nippon Steel in a speech as being evil and far worse than China because they taught China how to overproduce and dump. But beyond the politics and name-calling, the key issue is what will most likely help the U.S. steel industry modernize and expand capacity. Cleveland-Cliffs might be from home, but their offer and prospects have a hard time matching up to Nippon's. For shareholders, Cleveland-Cliffs' offer was objectively worse. Nippon offered $55 per share, all cash. Cleveland-Cliffs' highest final offer was $54 per share-ish, and only half in cash, the rest in stock. And the stock price has not done well since the January 2024 offer. That is why the deal passed the shareholder vote by lopsided North Korean-like margins. 98.1% of the shareholders voted yes. I know, nobody cares about the shareholders, but what about future investments? There are questions about whether Cleveland-Cliffs has the money to make the formidable investments needed to modernize U.S. Steel's facilities. Cleveland's net income and return on capital ratios have been declining since 2021. Extensive investments upgrading older facilities like those once owned by AK Steel, plus buying Stelco for $2.5 billion in 2024, has left the company with a heavy debt load in recent years. Earnings are weak and rating agencies are worried. Can Cleveland afford to invest another billion into Mon Valley? Can they invest in R&D like Nippon can and does? And by the way, just because Cleveland is committed to unions does not immunize them from difficult economics. They recently closed one unionized factory in West Virginia in February 2024. Nippon Steel, on the other hand, is profitable, $3.7 billion in 2025, generates a lot of cash, and has debt capacity, having paid down a good amount of it since 2022. A combined Cleveland-Cliffs U.S. Steel company might dominate the American market, but would remain a pipsqueak internationally, lacking the firepower to improve their competitiveness. So most likely, the company spends the crucial next few years selling assets, cutting debt, eliminating non-union positions to save money, and raising prices on customers to take fullest advantages of a new protectionist trade environment. Shortly after Biden blocked the deal on national security grounds, Nippon sued the U.S. government. In their lawsuit, they accused the Biden administration of not reviewing the deal in good faith, instead seeking to curry favor with the USW to get their support for the 2024 U.S. presidential election. Biden's party lost anyway, which I reckon says something, but not sure what, and a different administration took power. And if there is something consistent about the new president, it is that he likes a deal. After unveiling his Liberation Day tariffs in April 2025, Trump reopened the door to re-reviewing the U.S. Steel deal. And thanks to some lobbying by people on both the American and Japanese sides, it seems like the new administration recognized several key issues. Steel is the sinew and skeleton of industry and manufacturing, and the People's Republic of China has 13 times more steel capacity than the United States. Nippon is offering to invest $11 billion more into steel plants on U.S. soil to help close that gap. Side note, how that number is counted and whether it goes through, who knows. But Nippon is motivated and has the money and technology to expand the U.S. industrial base. Anyway, things went back and forth for a while. Since they would be transferring their advanced proprietary steel technology, Nippon wanted 100% ownership. But the U.S. government insisted on American total control. Finally, Nippon's offer to issue the aforementioned golden share helped convince the administration. In mid-June, Trump lifted the block, and the acquisition, carefully characterized by Nippon as a quote-unquote partnership, closed shortly thereafter. I get it. U.S. Steel has a 120-plus year history that involves American giants like J.P. Morgan and Andrew Carnegie, and it's an icon of American industrial prowess. But it is a company, not a national park. And companies with iconic names in the U.S., Europe, and Asia get bought all the time, sometimes even by foreigners. Aston Martin, Ferrari, Budweiser, Sharp. Change the name from U.S. Steel to Asianometry Iron Alloys Corporation and take a hard look at where the company is now via the latest annual report. In 2024, Asianometry Iron Alloys net sales fell 13% and profits by more than half, with every steel product category down. There are hundreds of millions of dollars of open environmental liabilities with more down the line. The company sells a commodity product in a steel market about 630 million tons in oversupply, and it competes against massive competitors from the greatest steelmaking nation of all of history, competitors with little or no concern for making profits. Things were looking up, but this is a company in danger, and I think Nippon is a great home for it. The U.S. Steel name will live on. Pittsburgh's communities will get precious new capital, and if the Japanese treat the company like how they once treated its now competitors, then U.S. Steel is in good hands. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight, thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.